Black Boy, Disc 13.
The feud that went on between Brand and Cook continued. Although they were working daily in a building where scientific history was being made, the light of curiosity was never in their eyes. They were conditioned to their racial place, had learned to see only a part of the whites and the white world, and the whites, too, had learned to see only a part of the lives of the blacks and their world. Perhaps Brandon Cook, lacking interests that could absorb them, fuming like children over trifles, simply invented their hate of each other in order to have something to feel deeply about. Or perhaps there was in them a vague psyche pain stemming from their chronically frustrating way of life, a pain whose cause they did not know. And like those devocalized dogs, they would whirl and snap at the air when their old pain struck them. Anyway, they argued about the weather, sports, sex, war, race, politics, and religion. Neither of them knew the subjects they debated, but it seemed that the less they knew, the better they could argue. The tug of war between the two elderly men reached a climax one winter day at noon. It was incredibly cold, and an icy gale swept up and down the Chicago streets with blizzard force. The door of the animal-filled room was locked, for we always insisted that we be allowed 1 hour in which to eat and rest. Bill and I were sitting on wooden boxes, eating our lunches out of paper bags. Brand was washing his hands at the sink. Cook was sitting on a rickety stool, munching an apple and reading the Chicago Daily Tribune. Now and then, a devocalized dog lifted his nose to the ceiling and howled, soundlessly. The room was filled with many rows of high steel tiers. Perched upon each of these tiers were layers of steel cages containing the dogs, rats, mice, rabbits, and guinea pigs. Each cage was labeled in some indecipherable scientific jargon. Along the walls of the room were long charts with zigzagging red and black lines that traced the success or failure of some experiment. The lonely piping of guinea pigs floated unheeded about us. Hay rustled as a rabbit leaped restlessly about in its pen. A rat scampered around in its steel prison. Cook tapped the newspaper for attention.
"It says here," Cook mumbled through a mouthful of apple, "that this is the coldest day since 1888.
Bill and I sat unconcerned. Brand chuckled softly.
"What in the hell you laughing about?" Cook demanded of Brand.
"You can't believe what the damn Tribune says," Brand said.
"How come I can't?" Cook demanded. "It's the world's greatest newspaper."
Brand did not reply. He shook his head pityingly and chuckled again.
"Stop that damn laughing at me," Cook said angrily.
"I laugh as much as I wanna," Brand said. "You don't know what you're talking about. The Herald Examiner says it's the coldest day since 1873.
"But the Trib ought to know," Cook countered. "It's older than that Examiner."
"That damn Trib don't know nothing,"
Brand drowned out Cook's voice.
"How in hell you know?"
Cook asked with rising anger. The argument waxed until Cook shouted that if Brand did not shut up, he was going to
cut his black throat.
Brand whirled from the sink, his hands dripping soapy water, his eyes blazing.
"Take that back," Brand said.
"I take nothing back. What you want to do about it?" Cook taunted.
The two elderly Negroes glared at each other. I wondered if the quarrel was really serious, or if it would turn out harmlessly, as so many others had done. Suddenly, Cook dropped the Chicago Daily Tribune and pulled a long knife from his pocket. His thumb pressed a button, and a gleaming steel blade leaped out. Brand stepped back quickly and seized an ice pick that was stuck in a wooden board above the sink.
Put that knife down, Brand said. Stay away from me, or I'll cut your throat, Cook warned.
Brand lunged with the ice pick. Cook dodged out of range. They circled each other like fighters in a prize ring. The cancerous and tubercular rats and mice leaped about their cages. The guinea pigs whistled in fright. The diabetic dogs bared their teeth and barked soundlessly in our direction. The Aschheim Zondik rabbits flopped their ears and tried to hide in the corners of their pens. Cook now crouched and sprang forward with the knife. Bill and I jumped to our feet, speechless with surprise. Brand retreated. The eyes of both men were hard and unblinking. They were breathing deeply.
Say, cut it out, I called in alarm. Them damn fools is really fighting, Bill said in amazement.
Slashing at each other, Brand and Cook surged up and down the aisles of steel tiers. Suddenly, Brand uttered a bellow and charged into Cook and swept him violently backward. Cook grasped Brand's hand to keep the ice pick from sinking into his chest. Brand broke free and charged Cook again, sweeping him into an animal-filled steel tier. The tier balanced itself on its edge for an indecisive moment, then toppled. Like kingpins, one steel tier lammed into another, then they all crashed to the floor with a sound as of the roof falling. The whole aspect of the room altered quicker than the eye could follow. Brand and Cook stood stock still, their eyes fastened upon each other, their pointed weapons raised, but they were dimly aware of the havoc that churned about them. The steel tiers lay jumbled. The doors of the cages swung open. Rats and mice and dogs and rabbits moved over the floor in wild panic. The Wasserman guinea pigs were squealing as though judgment day had come. Here and there, an animal had been crushed beneath a cage. All four of us looked at one another. We knew what this meant. We might lose our jobs. We were already regarded as black dunces. But if the doctors saw this mess, they would take it as final proof. Bill rushed to the door to make sure that it was locked. I glanced at the clock and saw that it was 12:30. We had 1/2 hour of grace. Come on, Bill said uneasily. We got to get this place clean. Brandon Cook stared at each other, both doubting. Give me a knife, Cook, I said.
Nah, take Brand's ice pick first, Cook said. The hell you say, Brand said. Take his knife first.
A knock sounded at the door.
Shh,
Bill said. We waited. We heard footsteps going away. We'll all lose our jobs, I thought. Persuading the fighters to surrender their weapons was a difficult task, but at last it was done, and we could begin to right things. Slowly, Brand stooped and tugged at one end of a steel tier. Cook stooped to help him. Both men seemed to be acting in a dream. Soon, however, all four of us were working frantically, watching the clock. As we labored, we conspired to keep the fight a secret. We agreed to tell the doctors, if any should ask, that we hadn't been in the room during our lunch hour. We felt that that lie would explain why no one had unlocked the door when the knock had come. We righted the tiers and replaced the cages. Then we were faced with the impossible task of sorting the cancerous rats and mice, the diabetic dogs, the Aschheim Zondik rabbits, and the Wasserman guinea pigs. Whether we kept our jobs or not depended upon how shrewdly we could cover up all evidence of the fight. It was pure guesswork, but we had to try to put the animals back into the correct cages. We knew that certain rats or mice went into certain cages, but we didn't know what rat or mouse went into what cage. We didn't know a tubercular mouse from a cancerous mouse. The white doctors had made sure that we wouldn't know. They had never taken time to answer a single question. Though we worked in the Institute, we were as remote from the meaning of the experiments as if we lived in the moon. The doctors had laughed at what they felt was our childlike interest in the fate of the animals. First, we sorted the dogs. That was fairly easy, for we could remember the size and color of most of them. But the rats and mice and guinea pigs baffled us completely. We put our heads together and pondered, down in the underworld of the great scientific institute. It was a strange scientific conference. The fate of the entire medical research institute rested in our ignorant black hands. We remembered the number of rats, mice, or guinea pigs. We had to handle them several times a day. That went into a given cage. And we supplied the number helter-skelter from those animals that we could catch running loose on the floor. We discovered that many rats, mice, and guinea pigs were missing. They had been killed in the scuffle. We solved that problem by taking healthy stock from other cages and putting them into cages with sick animals. We repeated this process until we were certain that, numerically at least, all the animals with which the doctors were experimenting were accounted for. The rabbits came last. We broke the rabbits down into two general groups, those that had fur on their bellies and those that did not. We knew that all those rabbits that had shaven bellies, our scientific knowledge adequately covered this point because it was our job to shave the rabbits, were undergoing Asheim-Zondek tests. But in what pen did a given rabbit belong? We didn't know. I solved the problem very simply. I counted the shaven rabbits. They numbered 17. I counted the pens labeled Asheim-Zondek, then proceeded to drop a shaven rabbit into each pen at random. And again, we were numerically successful. At least, white America had taught us how to count. Lastly, we carefully wrapped all the dead animals in newspapers and hid their bodies in a garbage can. At a few minutes to one, the room was in order. That is, the kind of order that we four Negroes could figure out. I unlocked the door and we sat, waiting, whispering, vowing secrecy, wondering what the reaction of the doctors would be. Finally, a doctor came, gray-haired, white-coated, spectacled, efficient, serious, taciturn, bearing a tray upon which sat a bottle of mysterious fluid and a hypodermic needle. "My rats, please." Cook shuffled forward to serve him. We held our breath. Cook got the cage, which he knew the doctor always called for at that hour, and brought it forward. One by one, Cook took out the rats and held them as the doctor solemnly injected the mysterious fluid under their skins. "Thank you, Cook," the doctor murmured. "Not at all, sir," Cook mumbled, with a suppressed gasp. When the doctor had gone, we looked at one another, hardly daring to believe that our secret would be kept. We were so anxious that we didn't know whether to curse or laugh. Another doctor came. "Give me AZ rabbit number 14. "Yes, sir," I said. I brought him the rabbit, and he took it upstairs to the operating room. We waited for repercussions. None came. All that afternoon, the doctors came and went. I would run into the room, stealing a few seconds from my step scrubbing, and ask what progress was being made, and would learn that the doctors had detected nothing. At quitting time, we felt triumphant. "They won't never know," Cook boasted in a whisper. I saw Brand stiffen. I knew that he was aching to dispute Cook's optimism, but the memory of the fight he had just had was so fresh in his mind that he could not speak. Another day went by, and nothing happened. Then another day. The doctors examined the animals and wrote in their little black books, in their big black books, and continued to trace red and black lines upon the charts. A week passed, and we felt out of danger. Not one question had been asked. Of course, We four black men were much too modest to make our contribution known, but we often wondered what went on in the laboratories after that secret disaster. Was some scientific hypothesis well on its way to validation and ultimate public use discarded because of unexpected findings on that cold winter day? Was some tested principle given a new and strange refinement because of fresh, remarkable evidence? Did some brooding research worker, those who held stopwatches and slopped their feet carelessly in the water of the steps I tried so hard to keep clean, get a wild, if brief, glimpse of a new scientific truth? Well, we never heard. I brooded, of course, upon whether I should have gone to the director's office and told him what had happened, but each time I thought of it, I remembered the director had been the man who had ordered the boy to stand over me while I was working and time my movements with a stopwatch. He did not regard me as a human being. I didn't share his world. I earned $13 a week, and I had to support four people with it. And should I risk that $13 by acting idealistically? Brandon Cook would have hated me and would have eventually driven me from the job had I told on them. The hospital kept us four Negroes, as though we were close kin to the animals we tended, huddled together down in the underworld corridors of the hospital, separated by a vast psychological distance from the significant processes of the rest of the hospital. Just as America had kept us locked in the dark underworld of American life for 300 years. And we had made our own code of ethics, values, loyalty. Chapter 18. One Thursday night, I received an invitation from a group of white boys I had known in the post office to meet in a South Side hotel and argue the state of the world. About 10 of us gathered and ate salami sandwiches, drank beer, and talked. I was amazed to discover that many of them had joined the Communist Party. I challenged them by reciting the antics of the Negro communists I had seen in the parks, and I was told that those antics were tactics and were all right. I was dubious. Then one Thursday night, Saul, a Jewish chap, startled us by announcing that he'd had a short story accepted by a little magazine called The Anvil, edited by Jack Conroy, and that he had joined a revolutionary artists' organization, the John Reed Club. Saul repeatedly begged me to attend the meetings of the club, but I always found an easy excuse for refusing. "You'd like them," Saul said. "I don't want to be organized," I said. "They can help you to write," he said. "Nobody can tell me how or what to write," I said. "Come and see," he urged. "What have you to lose?" I felt that communists could not possibly have a sincere interest in Negroes. I was cynical, and I would rather have heard a white man say that he hated Negroes, which I could have readily believed, than to have heard him say that he respected Negroes, which would have made me doubt him. I don't think that there existed many whites who, through intellectual effort, could lift themselves out of the traditions of their times and see the Negro objectively. One Saturday night, sitting home idle, not caring to visit the girls I had met on my former insurance route, bored with reading, I decided to appear at the John Reed Club in the capacity of an amused spectator. I rode to the loop and found the number. A dark stairway led upstairs. It did not look welcoming. What on earth of importance could transpire in so dingy a place? Through the windows above me, I saw vague murals along the walls. I mounted the stairs to a door that was lettered, "The Chicago John Reed Club." I opened it and stepped into the strangest room I had ever seen. Paper and cigarette butts lay on the floor. A few benches ran along the walls, above which were vivid colors depicting colossal figures of workers carrying streaming banners. The mouths of the workers gaped in wild cries, their legs sprawled over cities. "Hello." I turned and saw a white man smiling at me. "A friend of mine who's a member of this club asked me to visit here. His name is Saul," I told him. "You're welcome here," the white man said. "We're not having an affair tonight. We're holding an editorial meeting. Do you paint?" He was slightly gray, and he had a mustache. "No," I said. "I try to write." "Then sit in on the editorial meeting of our magazine, left front," he suggested. "I know nothing of editing," I said. "You can learn," he said. I stared at him, doubting. "I don't want to be in the way here," I said. "My name's Grimm," he said. I told him my name, and we shook hands. He went to a closet and returned with an armful of magazines. "Here are some back issues of The Masses," he said. "Have you ever read it?" "No," I said. "Some of the best writers in America publish in it," he explained. He also gave me copies of a magazine called International Literature. "There's stuff here from Gide, Gorky." I assured him that I would read them. He took me to an office and introduced me to a Jewish boy who was to become one of the nation's leading painters, to a chap who was to become one of the eminent composers of his day, to a writer who was to create some of the best novels of his generation, to a young Jewish boy who was destined to film the Nazi invasion of Czechoslovakia. I was meeting men and women whom I would know for decades to come, who were to form the first sustained relationships in my life. I sat in a corner and listened while they discussed their magazine, Left Front. Were they treating me courteously because I was a Negro? I must let cold reason guide me with these people, I told myself. I was asked to contribute something to the magazine, and I said vaguely that I would consider it. After the meeting, I met an Irish girl who worked for an advertising agency, a girl who did social work, a school teacher, and the wife of a prominent university professor. I had once worked as a servant for people like these, and I was skeptical. I tried to fathom their motives, but I could detect no condescension in them. I went home full of reflection, probing the sincerity of the strange white people I had met, wondering how they really regarded Negroes. I lay on my bed and read the magazines and was amazed to find that there did exist in this world an organized search for the truth of the lives of the oppressed and the isolated. When I had begged bread from the officials, I had wondered dimly if the outcasts could become united in action, thought, and feeling. Now, I knew. It was being done in 1/6 of the earth already. The revolutionary words leaped from the printed page and struck me with tremendous force. It was not the economics of communism, nor the great power of trade unions, nor the excitement of underground politics that claimed me. My attention was caught by the similarity of the experiences of workers in other lands, by the possibility of uniting scattered but kindred peoples into a whole. My cynicism, which had been my protection against an America that had cast me out, slid from me, and timidly, I began to wonder if a solution of unity was possible. My life as a Negro in America had led me to feel, though my helplessness had made me try to hide it from myself, that the problem of human unity was more important than bread, more important than physical living itself. For I felt that without a common bond uniting men, without a continuous current of shared thought and feeling circulating through the social system, like blood coursing through the body, there could be no living worthy of being called human. I hungered to share the dominant assumptions of my time and act upon them. I didn't want to feel, like an animal in the jungle, that the whole world was alien and hostile. I didn't want to make individual war or individual peace. So far, I'd managed to keep humanly alive through transfusions from books. In my concrete relations with others, I'd encountered nothing to encourage me to believe in my feelings. It had been by denying what I saw with my eyes, disputing what I felt with my body, that I had managed to keep my identity intact. But it seemed to me that here at last, in the realm of revolutionary expression, was where Negro experience could find a home, a functioning value, and role. Out of the magazines I read came a passionate call for the experiences of the disinherited, and there were none of the lame lispings of the missionary in it. It did not say, "Be like us, and we will like you, maybe." It said, "If you possess enough courage to speak out what you are, you will find that you are not alone." It urged life to believe in life. I read on into the night. Then, toward dawn, I swung from bed and inserted paper into the typewriter. Feeling for the first time that I could speak to listening ears, I wrote a wild, crude poem in free verse, coining images of black hands playing, working, holding bayonets, stiffening finally in death. I read it, and felt in a clumsy way it linked white life with black, merged two streams of common experience. I heard someone poking about the kitchen. "Richard, are you ill?" my mother called. "No, I'm reading." My mother opened the door and stared curiously at the pile of magazines that lay upon my pillow. "You're not throwing away money buying those magazines, are you?" she asked. "No, they were given to me." She hobbled to the bed on her crippled legs and picked up a copy of The Masses that carried a lurid May Day cartoon. She adjusted her glasses and peered at it for a long time. "My God in heaven," she breathed in horror. "What's the matter, Mama?" "What is this?" she asked, extending the magazine to me, pointing to the cover. "What's wrong with that man?" With my mother standing at my side, lending me her eyes, I stared at a cartoon drawn by a communist artist. It was the figure of a worker clad in ragged overalls and holding aloft a red banner. The man's eyes bulged, his mouth gaped as wide as his face. His teeth showed. The muscles of his neck were like ropes. Following the man was a horde of nondescript men, women, and children, waving clubs, stones, pitchforks. "What are those people going to do?" my mother asked. "I don't know," I hedged. "Are these communist magazines?"
"Yes."
"And do they want people to act like this?"
"Well," I hesitated.
My mother's face showed disgust and moral loathing. She was a gentle woman. Her ideal was Christ upon the cross. How could I tell her that the Communist Party wanted her to march in the streets, chanting, singing?
"What do communists think people are?" she asked.
"They don't quite mean what you see there," I said, fumbling with my words.
"Then what do they mean?"
"This is symbolic," I said.
"Then why don't they speak out what they mean?"
"Maybe they don't know how."
"Then why do they print this stuff?"
"They don't quite know how to appeal to people yet," I admitted, wondering whom I could convince of this if I could not convince my mother.
"That picture's enough to drive a body crazy," she said, dropping the magazine, turning to leave, then pausing at the door. "You're not getting mixed up with those people."
"I'm just reading, Mama," I dodged.
My mother left, and I brooded upon the fact that I hadn't been able to meet her simple challenge. I looked again at the cover of The Masses, and I knew that the wild cartoon didn't reflect the passions of the common people. I reread the magazine, and was convinced that much of the expression embodied what the artists thought would appeal to others, what they thought would gain recruits. They had a program, an ideal, but they hadn't yet found a language. Here, then, was something that I could do,
reveal, say. The communists, I felt, had oversimplified the experience of those whom they sought to lead. In their efforts to recruit masses, they had missed the meaning of the lives of the masses, had conceived of people in too abstract a manner. I would make voyages, discoveries, explorations with words, and try to put some of that meaning back. I would address my words to two groups. I would tell communists how common people felt, and I would tell common people of the self-sacrifice of communists who strove for unity among them. That following Thursday night, when I joined my friends at the hotel for beer, I pulled out my crude verses and laid them on the table. Saul read them. "This can be published," he said. "That's not the point," I said. "What do they mean to you?" "This is the vision of the disinherited," he said. "If you're going to publish these to recruit me into the party, then nothing doing," I said. "They'll be published whether you join or not," he said. I told the group of my mother's reaction to the masses cartoon. "She'll have to learn the symbolism of the revolution," somebody said. "But why can't communism speak a language she understands?" I asked. There was a lot of argument that went nowhere. Still suspicious, my eyes watching for the slightest anti-Negro gesture, I attended the next meeting of the club. In the end, I had to admit that they were glad to have me with them, but I still doubted their motives. Were they trying to get my head bashed in a picket line so that they could capitalize on the publicity? Or did the discipline of the club demand that they be friendly with me? If that was true, then those who didn't want a Negro in the club could resign. But no one made a move to resign. How had these people, denying profit and home and God, made that hurdle that even the churches of America hadn't been able to make? The editor of Left Front accepted two of my crude poems for publication, sent two of them to Jack Conroy's Anvil, and sent another to the New Masses, the successor of The Masses. Doubts still lingered in my mind. "Don't send them if you think they aren't good enough," I said. "They're good enough," he said. "Are you doing this to get me to join up?" I asked. "No," he said. "Your poems are crude, but good for us. You see, we're all new in this. We write articles about Negroes, but we never see any Negroes. We need your stuff." I sat through several meetings of the club and was impressed by the scope and seriousness of its activities. The club was demanding that the government create jobs for unemployed artists. It planned and organized art exhibits. It raised funds for the publication of Left Front. And it sent scores of speakers to trade union meetings. The members were fervent, democratic, restless, eager, self-sacrificing. I was convinced, and my response was to set myself the task of making Negroes know what communists were. While mopping the operating rooms of the Medical Research Institute, I got the notion of writing a series of biographical sketches of Negro communists. I told no one of my intentions, and I didn't know how fantastically naive my ambition was. I had attended but a few meetings before I realized that a bitter, factional fight was in progress between two groups of members of the club. But when I tried to learn the nature of the fight, no one would tell me anything. Sharp arguments rose at every meeting. I noticed that a small group of painters actually led the club and dominated its policies. The group of writers that centered about Left Front resented the leadership of the painters. Being primarily interested in Left Front, I sided in simple loyalty with the writers. Then came a strange development. The Left Front group declared that the incumbent leadership didn't reflect the wishes of the club. A special meeting was called, and a motion was made to re-elect an executive secretary. When nominations were made for the office, my name was included. I declined the nomination, telling the members that I was too ignorant of their aims to be seriously considered. The debate lasted all night. A vote was taken in the early hours of morning by a show of hands, and I was elected. I had been a member of the club for less than 2 months and didn't fully understand the purposes of the organization. Later, I learned what had happened. The writers of the club had decided to use me to oust the painters, who were party members, from the leadership of the club. Without my knowledge and consent, they confronted the members of the party with a Negro, knowing that it would be difficult for communists to refuse to vote for a man representing the largest single racial minority in the nation, inasmuch as Negro equality was one of the main tenets of communism. Though I was not a communist, cynical rivalry had put me in charge of one of the party's leading cultural organizations. At once I offered my resignation, but the members wouldn't hear of it. I couldn't determine if they were acting sincerely. I was afraid that the defeated secretary, being white, would resent losing to a Negro, but his conduct showed nothing but friendliness. As the club's leader, I soon learned the nature of the fight. The communists had secretly organized a fraction in the club, that is, a small portion of the club's members were secret members of the Communist Party. They would meet outside of the club, decide what policies the clubs should follow, and when they put forth their proposals in open meetings, the sheer strength of their arguments usually persuaded non-party members to vote with them. The crux of the fight was that the non-party members resented the excessive demands made upon the club by the local party authorities through the fraction. For example, the fraction demanded that the Daily Worker and the New Masses, official periodicals of the Communist Party, be put on sale at all meetings. The non-party group declared that this would limit the club's membership to those who already believed in communism. The demands of the local party authorities for money, speakers, and poster painters were so great that the publication of Left Front was in danger. Many young writers had joined the club because of their hope of publishing in Left Front, and when the Communist Party sent word through the fraction that the magazine should be dissolved, the writers rejected the decision, an act which was interpreted as hostility toward party authority. I pleaded with the party members for a more liberal program for the club. Feelings waxed violent and bitter. Then the showdown came. I was informed that if I wanted to continue as secretary of the club, I would have to join the Communist Party. I stated that I favored a policy that allowed for the development of writers and artists. My policy was accepted. I signed the membership card. As the club's leader, I strove to keep the quarrels within limits by striking a series of compromises. For example, the sale of the Daily Worker was withdrawn, but the sale of the New Masses was continued. My position was in the middle. The fraction urged me to collect money from the members for the Communist Party, and the members urged me to fight for the continuance of Left Front, which had been branded as useless by the Communist Party. Trying to please everybody, I pleased nobody. The club's energies were sapped by internal strife. Bills piled up, rent fell past due. I wanted the club to continue at all hazards. My feelings were intensely personal. The club was my first contact with the modern world. I had lived so utterly isolated a life that the club filled for me a need that couldn't be imagined by the white members who were becoming disgusted with it, whose normal living had given them what I was so desperately trying to get. One night, a Jewish chap appeared at one of our meetings and introduced himself as Comrade Young of Detroit. He told us that he was a member of the Communist Party, a member of the Detroit John Reed Club, that he planned to make his home in Chicago. He was a short, friendly, black-haired, well-read fellow, with hanging lips and bulging eyes. Shy of forces to execute the demands of the Communist Party, we welcomed him. But I couldn't make out Young's personality. Whenever I asked him a simple question, he looked off and stammered a confused answer. I decided to send his references to the Communist Party for checking, and forthwith named him for membership in the club. He's okay, I thought. Just a queer artist. After the meeting, Comrade Young confronted me with a problem. He had no money, he said, and asked if he could sleep temporarily on the club's premises. Believing him loyal, I gave him permission. Straightway, Young became one of the most ardent members of our organization, admired by all. His paintings, which I didn't understand, impressed our best artists. No report about Young had come from the Communist Party, but since Young seemed a conscientious worker, I didn't think the omission serious in any case. At a meeting one night, Young asked that his name be placed upon the agenda. When his time came to speak, he rose and launched into one of the most violent and bitter political attacks upon Swan, one of our best young artists, in the club's history. We were aghast. Young accused Swan of being a traitor to the workers, an opportunist, a collaborator with the police, and an adherent of Trotsky. Naturally, most of the club's members assumed that Young, a member of the party, was voicing the ideas of the party. Surprised and baffled, I moved that Young's statement be referred to the executive committee for decision. Swan rightfully protested. He declared that he had been attacked in public and would answer in public. It was voted that Swan should have the floor. He refuted Young's wild charges, but the majority of the club's members were bewildered, didn't know whether to believe him or not. We all liked Swan, did not believe him guilty of any misconduct, but we didn't want to offend the party. A verbal battle ensued. Finally, the members who had been silent in deference to the party rose and demanded of me that the foolish charges against Swan be withdrawn. Again, I moved that the matter be referred to the executive committee, and again my proposal was voted down. The membership had now begun to distrust the party's motives. They were afraid to let an executive committee, the majority of whom were party members, pass upon the charges made by party member Young. Three meetings were consumed in bitter debate. Between meetings, we urged Young to tell us who had given him the authority to castigate Swan, and Young hinted darkly that he was acting under the orders of either the Central Committee of the Communist Party or the Communist International. And we were naturally impressed. Who were we to question the decisions of political bodies so highly placed? I sympathized with Swan, but was afraid to say a word in his behalf for fear that I, too, would be charged. A delegation of members asked me if I had anything to do with Young's charges. I was so hurt and humiliated that I disavowed all relations with Young. Determined to end the farce, I cornered Young and demanded to know who had given him authority. "I've been asked to rid the club of traitors," he said. "But Swan isn't a traitor," I said. "We must have a purge," he said, his eyes bulging, his face quivering with passion. I admitted his great revolutionary fervor, but I felt that his zeal was a trifle excessive. The situation became worse. A delegation of members informed me that if the charges against Swan weren't withdrawn, they would resign in a body. I was frantic. I wrote to the Communist Party to ask why orders had been issued to punish Swan, and a reply came back that no such orders had been issued. Then what was Young up to? Who was prompting him? I finally begged the club to let me place the matter before the leaders of the Communist Party for decision. After a violent debate, my proposal was accepted. One night, 10 of us met in an office of a leader of the party to hear Young restate his charges against Swan. The party leader, aloof and amused, gave Young the signal to begin. Young unrolled a sheaf of papers and declaimed a list of political charges that excelled in viciousness his previous charges. An instinct warned me that something was wrong, but I couldn't make out what it was. I stared at Young, feeling that he was making a dreadful mistake, but fearing him, because he had, by his own account, the sanction of high political authority. When Young had finished, the party leader asked, "Will you allow me to read these charges?" "Of course," said Young, surrendering a copy of his indictment. "You may keep that copy. I have 10 carbons." "Why did you make so many carbons?" the leader asked. "I didn't want anyone to steal them," Young said. "If this man's charges against me are taken seriously," Swan said, "I'll resign and publicly denounce the club." "You see," Young yelled, "he's with the police." I was sick. The meeting ended with a promise from the party leader to read the charges carefully and render a verdict as to whether Swan should be placed on trial or not. I was convinced that something was wrong, but I couldn't figure it out. One afternoon, I went to the club to have a long talk with Young, but when I arrived, he wasn't there. Nor was he there the next day. For a week, I sought Young in vain. What had become of the man? I asked about him far and wide, but could get no word. Meanwhile, the club's members asked his whereabouts, and they wouldn't believe me when I told them I didn't know. Was he ill? Had he been picked up by the police? Somebody suggested that we search Young's luggage, which was still in the club's back room. One afternoon, Comrade Grimm and I sneaked into the club's headquarters and opened Young's luggage. What we saw amazed and puzzled us. First of all, there was a scroll of paper 20 yards long, one page pasted to another, which had drawings depicting the history of the human race from a Marxist point of view. The first page was titled, "A Pictorial Record of Man's Economic Progress." "This is terribly ambitious," I said. "He's very studious," Grimm said. There were long dissertations written in longhand. Some were political, and others dealt with the history of art. Finally, we found a letter with a Detroit return address, and I promptly wrote asking news of our esteemed member. A few days later, a letter came, which said in part, "Dear Sir, in reply to your letter, we beg to inform you that Mr. Young, who was a patient in our institution, and who escaped from our custody a few months ago, has been apprehended and returned to this institution for mental treatment." I was thunderstruck. Was this true? Undoubtedly, it was. Then what kind of club did we run that a lunatic could step into it and help run it? Were we all so mad that we couldn't detect a madman when we saw one? I called a meeting of a few of the most trusted members of the club and laid the matter before them. They were dumbfounded. We swore ourselves to secrecy and decided to suppress the matter. We agreed that we had made a terrible mistake. But, of course, we had no power to restrain the other members from asking questions. Swan hammered at us from meeting to meeting. "Where is Comrade Young? Is he sick? Is he dead? Is he in jail? Did the Communist Party order him to stay away from the club?" And to these questions, I could but lie, "I've had no word from Comrade Young. As soon as any is received, I'll inform the club." Meanwhile, I made a motion that all charges against Swan be dropped, which was done. I offered Swan an apology, but as the leader of the Chicago John Reed Club, I was a completely sober and chastened communist. Chapter 19. I had read widely in revolutionary literature, had observed many communists, white and black, and had learned to know the daily hazards they faced and the sacrifices they made. I now wanted to give time to writing the book of biographical sketches I had planned. I didn't know Negro communists as well as I wanted to, and when, on many occasions, I had sought to question them about their feelings, their work, and their actions, they had been reticent. My zeal made me forget these rebuffs, for I was sure that an atmosphere of trust would be created as soon as I had explained my project to them. The Communist Party fraction in the John Reed Club instructed me to ask my party cell, or unit, as it was called, to assign me to full duty in the work of the club. I was instructed to give my unit a report of my activities, writing, organizing, speaking. I agreed to do this and wrote a report. A unit, membership in which is obligatory for all communists, is the party's basic form of organization. Unit meetings are held on certain nights, which are kept secret for fear of police raids. Nothing treasonable transpires at these meetings, but once one is a communist, one doesn't have to be guilty of wrongdoing to attract the attention of the police. At these meetings, members pay their dues, are given party tasks, are instructed in the party's interpretation of world events. I went to my first unit meeting, which was held in the Black Belt of the South Side, and introduced myself to the Negro organizer.
"Welcome, comrade," he said, grinning. "We're glad to have a writer with us."
"I'm not much of a writer," I said. The meeting started. About 20 Negroes were gathered. The time came for me to make my report, and I took out my notes and told them how I had come to join the party, what few stray items I had published, what my duties were in the John Reed Club. I finished and waited for comment. There was silence. I looked about. Most of the comrades sat with bowed heads. Then I was surprised to catch a twitching smile on the lips of a Negro woman. Minutes passed. The Negro woman lifted her head and looked at the organizer. The organizer smothered a smile. Then the woman broke into unrestrained laughter, bending forward and burying her face in her hands. I stared. Had I said something funny? "What's the matter?" I asked. The giggling became general. The unit organizer, who had been dallying with his pencil, looked up.
"It's all right, comrade," he said. "We're glad to have a writer in the party."
There was more smothered laughter. Some of the more intelligent ones were striving to keep deadpan faces. What kind of people were these? I'd made a serious report, and now I heard giggles.
"I did the best I could," I said uneasily. "I realize that writing is not basic or important, but given time, I think I can make a contribution."
"We know you can, comrade," the black organizer said.
His tone was more patronizing than that of a southern white man. I grew angry. I thought I knew these people, but evidently I did not. I wanted to take issue with their attitude, but caution urged me to talk it over with others first. I left the meeting baffled. During the following days, I learned through discreet questioning that I had seemed a fantastic element to the black communists. I was shocked to hear that I, who had been only to grammar school, had been classified as an intellectual. What was an intellectual? I'd never heard the word used in the sense in which it was applied to me. I had thought that they might refuse me on the grounds that I was not politically advanced. I had thought they might place me on probation. I had thought they might say I would have to be investigated. But they had simply laughed. And I began to realize why so few sensitive Negroes had had the gall to come as close to them as I had. I learned, to my dismay, that the black communists in my unit had commented upon my shined shoes, my clean shirt, and the tie I had worn. Above all, my manner of speech had seemed an alien thing to them.
"He talked like a book," one of the Negro comrades had said, and that was enough to condemn me forever as bourgeois.
The more I learned of the Negro communists, the more I found that they were not vicious, that they had no intention to hurt. They just didn't know anything and didn't want to learn anything. They felt that all questions had been answered, and anyone who asked new ones or tried to answer old ones was dangerous. The word writer, was enough to make a black Chicago communist feel that the man to whom the word applied had gone wrong. I discovered that it wasn't wise to be seen reading books that were not endorsed by the Communist Party. On one occasion, I was asked to show a book that I carried under my arm. The comrade looked at it and shook his head. "What are you reading this for?" he asked. "It's interesting," I said. "Reading bourgeois books can only confuse you, comrade," he said, returning the book. "You seem convinced that I'm easily confused," I said. "You know," he said, his voice dropping to a low, confidential tone, "many comrades go wrong by reading the books of the bourgeoisie. The party in the Soviet Union had trouble with people like that." "Didn't Lenin read bourgeois books?" I asked.
"But you're not Lenin," he shot at me.
"Are there some books reserved for some people to read while others cannot read them?" I asked. "Comrade, you do not understand," he said. An invisible wall was building slowly between me and the people with whom I had cast my lot. Well, I would show them that all men who wrote books were not their enemies. I would communicate the meaning of their lives to people whom they couldn't reach. Then surely my intentions would merit their confidence. I dismissed the warning about the Soviet Union's trouble with intellectuals. I felt that it simply didn't apply to me. The problem I faced seemed a much simpler one. I had to win the confidence of people who had been misled so often that they were afraid of anybody who differed from themselves. Yet deep down, I feared their militant ignorance. In my party work, I met a Negro communist, Ross, who was under indictment for inciting to riot. I decided to use him in my series of biographical sketches. His trial was pending, and he was organizing support in his behalf. Ross was typical of the effective street agitator. Southern-born, he had migrated north, and his life reflected the crude hopes and frustrations of the peasant in the city. Distrustful but aggressive, he was a bundle of the weaknesses and virtues of a man struggling blindly between two societies, of a man living on the margin of a culture. I felt that if I could get his story, I would make known some of the difficulties inherent in the adjustment of a folk people to an urban environment. I would make his life more intelligible to others than it was to himself. I would reclaim his disordered days and cast them into a form that people could grasp, see, understand, and accept. I approached Ross and explained my plan. He was agreeable. He invited me to his home, introduced me to his Jewish wife, his young son, his friends. I talked to Ross for hours, explaining what I was about, cautioning him not to relate anything that he didn't want to divulge. "I'm after the things that made you a communist," I said. It was arranged that I was to visit Ross each morning and take notes for 2 hours. At last, I thought, I would reveal dramas of hope, fear, love, and hate that existed in these humble people. I would make these lives merge with the lives of the mass of mankind. I knew I could. My life had prepared me for this. Word spread in the Communist Party that I was taking notes on the life of Ross, and strange things began to happen. A quiet black communist came to my home one night and called me out to the street to speak to me in private. He made a prediction about my future that frightened me. "Intellectuals don't fit well into the party, right?" he said solemnly. "But I'm not an intellectual," I protested. "I sweep the streets for a living." I had just been assigned by the relief system to sweep the streets for $13 a week. "That doesn't make any difference," he said. "We've kept records of the trouble we've had with intellectuals in the past. It's estimated that only 13% of them remain in the party." "Why do they leave, since you insist upon calling me an intellectual?" I asked. Most of them drop out of their own accord, he said.
Well, I'm not dropping out, I said.
Some are expelled, he hinted gravely.
For what?
General opposition to the party's policies, he said.
But I'm not opposing anything in the party.
But you have to prove yourself.
What do you mean?
You'll have to prove your revolutionary loyalty.
That's what I'm trying to do through writing.
That's not the way to do it, he said. You must act.
How?
The party has a way of testing people.
Well, talk. What is this?
How do you react to police?
I don't react to them, I said. I've never been bothered by them.
Do you know Evans? He asked, referring to a local militant Negro communist.
Yes, I've seen him. I've met him.
Did you notice that he was injured?
Yes, his head was bandaged.
He got that wound from the police in a demonstration, he explained. That's proof of revolutionary loyalty.
Do you mean that I must get whacked over the head by cops to prove that I'm sincere? I asked.
I'm not suggesting anything, he said. I'm explaining.
That's a primitive way to measure sincerity, I gasped.
It's a practical way, he said.
Look, suppose a cop whacks me over the head and I suffer a brain concussion. Suppose I'm nuts after that. Can I write then? What will I have proven?
He didn't answer. He shook his head.
The Soviet Union has had to shoot a lot of intellectuals, he said.
Good God, I exclaimed. Do you know what you're saying? You're not in Russia. You're standing on a sidewalk in Chicago. You talk like a man lost in a fantasy.
He said nothing. I didn't know that the notes I was taking of Ross's life were being discussed by the local communist leaders, that my motives were already being questioned. And no doubt, my rash words didn't help any.
You've heard of Trotsky, haven't you? He asked.
Yes.
Do you know what happened to him?
He was banished from the Soviet Union, I said.
Do you know why?
Well, I stammered, trying not to reveal my ignorance of politics, for I hadn't followed the details of Trotsky's fight against the Communist Party of the Soviet Union.
It seems that after a decision had been made, he broke that decision by organizing against the party.
It was for counter-revolutionary activity, he snapped impatiently.
I learned afterwards that my answer had not been satisfactory, hadn't been couched in the acceptable phrases of bitter, anti-Trotsky denunciation.
I understand, I said, but I've never read Trotsky. What's his stand on minorities?
Why ask me? He asked. I don't read Trotsky.
Look, I asked, if you found me reading Trotsky, what would that mean to you?
You have no need to read Trotsky, he said.
Don't you think I can read Trotsky and not be influenced to follow him? I asked.
Comrade, you don't understand, he said in an annoyed tone. That ended the conversation. But that wasn't the last time I was to hear the phrase, "Comrade, you don't understand." I hadn't been aware of holding wrong ideas. I hadn't read any of Trotsky's works. Indeed, the very opposite had been true. It had been Stalin's The National and Colonial Question that had captured my interest. Stalin's book showed how diverse minorities could be welded into unity, and I regarded it as a most politically sensitive volume that revealed a new way of looking upon lost and beaten peoples. Of all the developments in the Soviet Union, the method by which scores of backward peoples had been led to unity on a national scale was what had enthralled me. I had read with awe how the communists had sent phonetic experts into the vast regions of Russia to listen to the stammering dialects of peoples oppressed for centuries by the czars. I had made the first total emotional commitment of my life when I read how the phonetic experts had given these tongueless people a language, newspapers, institutions. I had read how these forgotten folk had been encouraged to keep their old cultures, to see in their ancient customs meanings and satisfactions as deep as those contained in supposedly superior ways of living. I had exclaimed to myself how different this was from the way in which Negroes were sneered at in America. Then what was the meaning of the warning I had received from the black communists? Why was it that I was a suspected man because I wanted to reveal the vast physical and spiritual ravages of Negro life, the profundity latent in these rejected people, the dramas as old as man and the sun and the mountains and the seas that were transpiring in the poverty of black America? What was the danger in showing the kinship between the sufferings of the Negro and the sufferings of other people?
This ends Disc 13.